The confrontation between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu and its significance was the subject of a conversation that I had with Dr. Hatem Bazian from the University of California, which was recorded by Collision Course Video on May 25th.
At least 3-4 days, beginning from Thursday, President's speech in the State Department, followed by his speech on Sunday to AIPAC, followed by Netanyahu's speech to the joint Congress and Senate session, if anything, demonstrate that Netanyahu is running U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and AIPAC is dictating the terms. The second is that President Obama has no support at all among both parties when it comes to Israel's question, assuming that Obama has the best interest to put forward the policy. Even if he does, there is no support whatsoever from the Democrats, from the Republicans, from opinion makers across the spectrum in the United States. And to see the president having to stand in front of AIPAC and almost to apologize to them and to give the Israeli position from the U.S. president and stepping away from U.S. standing and policy in relation to the 1967 border in terms of Jerusalem being an occupied territory, in terms of the settlement, nothing whatsoever. Which for me is that's the second or third time that Netanyahu comes to the United States and gives the president a lesson on politics and power. You remember when the president in June 2008 gave his speech in Cairo, which spoke about settlements, spoke about the Palestinians' need to have rights of self-determination, and basically a flowery speech. When Netanyahu came to the United Nations, basically forced the president and forced the United States to omit any mentioning of settlement and basically to pull back from any position that was articulated publicly in Cairo. And once again here, the president goes to the State Department, gives this speech before he's heading out to Europe, and Netanyahu comes and puts the president in his place, both in the press conference that took place in the White House. Obama was almost silent, and Netanyahu was actually lecturing him and giving him a lesson, and then followed by the two speeches, both Sunday, by the president and Netanyahu. So it's essentially our foreign policy in this country is being run through AIPAC, and we have an actual president in Netanyahu who gets the support from the Congress and Senate, and our president in the White House has no support whatsoever. That's the odd reading of this last 4 days, just to see what is taking place. Whether it's orchestrated or not is beside the point, because the theater is already clear who's dictating the terms and who's setting the agenda. Whether that agenda is going to manifest further in the future is a different question.
Well, it's interesting that it's assumed that the President of the United States must be pro-Israel. And you see columns in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, that the President is anti-Israel. And even though he went further and bowed and scraped, and we also have to look at how other countries view the President, who, although every other president has been humiliated, every other one, since Gerald Ford, no one has been humiliated more than Obama has. And this tells people around the world and other countries on other issues dealing with the United States policy that they don't have anything to worry about. Obama does not have a backbone. And then even when he apologizes and prostrates himself in a sense, it's not enough. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. And the Republicans are chortling because now they see this as a wedge not to get so much Jewish voters, but that core major Jewish donor that the Democrats count on. And this is again, a crisis for the United States when there's so many other issues the United States has to deal with economically, apart from our failures in wars and the likely extension of U.S. troops staying in Iraq.
I think if we could compare it to the period of George Bush Sr., when he wanted to stand up to the Israel lobby at the time in relations to the settlement and
the loan guarantees.
The loan guarantees, and Secretary of State Baker at the time was trying to stand firm. And Netanyahu, once again, was at the time the prime minister who came in.
Well, it was Shamir at the
time.
Was
Shamir, but I think he was his...
But Netanyahu was heavily
involved. Was heavily involved and pressed the issue for Israel, and President Bush had to step back. And I think that's one of the ingredients or one of the elements that at least helped defeat Bush from getting a second term. And I think just the coverage in the past few days said that Obama's stand on Israel might be the wedge issue that would be used against him in the second term. It once again demonstrates and shows the power of the Israel lobby in this country that essentially can unseat a president that for all intents and purposes already done something in relation to Osama bin Laden hit, that if it's someone else, that would be sufficient for him to gain a second term. But now I think his stand on this issue possibly will undermine him moving forward.
One almost could argue, and I believe, that taking out bin Laden when he did, and obviously there was no rush to do it, so the timing meant before this event, the meeting that, you know, was to give him some credibility as being tough on the street, but again, it didn't stand up. And going back to first Bush, initially, he went to the American public saying he was going to vote against the loan, veto the loan guarantees when 1,000 quote-unquote Jewish lobbyists were on Capitol Hill, because he realized that if he had not done that, his veto of the loan guarantees would have been overridden. And then he maintained that until Rabin replaced Shamir, but he did pay the price. They started attacking Bush on the economy. Republicans deserted him, started saying, well, he's a, Arafat's a better friend of Bush than is Sharon or whoever, Shamir. And the same thing happened with George W. W. When he told Sharon, remember, to get out of Jenin, enough is enough. And the same kind of columns appeared by William Sapphire in the New York Times and George Will attacking him for questioning Israel. And then immediately Sharon became a man of peace. And so the ability of an Israeli prime minister to humiliate an American president is something that's taken for granted. And that's why the New York Times reported it was Netanyahu actually requested to the Republicans that he be invited. This was the last Thursday's New York Times that he'd be invited to speak, because as far as Israelis are concerned, the government's concerned, the U.S. Congress is their most important occupied territory.
Well, I think it's important for us to contextualize this period further than the Israel lobby and the visit. I think we're dealing with a complete tectonic shift in the Middle East. And in this sense, Netanyahu and the Israelis are attempting to try to secure an American, at least acquiescence, to what they think would be the final negotiations and the final agreement that they might place at the table for the Palestinians, which would be a demilitarized state in cantons, five cantons in the West Bank, with Israel controlling the Jordan Valley, and also securing all the settlements with the wall that has been built. And I think they want to secure this before any of the changes that took place in the Middle East get cemented, meaning the new democratic government that will come out in Egypt within the next few months. I think their election is in September. That revolution in Egypt has already shifted the landscape in the Middle East. We're not going to go back to the same type of politics where Netanyahu and the Israelis dictate and Egypt responds by putting more pressure on the Palestinians and the U.S. provides the financing and the threat to do so. So that change is coming. And we already seen this reflected in today. Actually, the Egyptians are going to open the Rafah crossing period, open regularly from 9 o'clock to 9 o'clock a.m. to 9 p.m. every day, and only to be closed on holidays and Fridays, which would be the weekly holidays. So that tectonic shift is occurring. Another democratic state will emerge in Tunisia, where the people also are determining their affairs, and they are not going to acquiesce to Israel's demands and needs in the region or the United States. So as such, we have to see this as part of this process that is taking place, where Netanyahu is attempting to secure those pieces before this titanic shift takes hold. Interestingly enough, last Wednesday, before Obama's speech in State Department, King Abdullah of Jordan was there, because likewise he's worried that this titanic shift is impacting his standing in Jordan. There's a massive democratic spring occurring in Jordan that they've been attempting to, once again, manipulate and prevent from occurring by playing the Jordanian-Palestinian card and trying to create that split, or tribes of the south versus tribes of the north, but I think it's unsustainable in Jordan. So this is the period we are, there is an attempt to try to maintain some resemblance of Israel interest in the region at a time where that interest have already collapsed.
Well, actually, it's interesting, the difference between the American press responding as positive response to Netanyahu, but the Israeli press, they're criticizing him. This is the Haaretz, of course, but even in other papers, they're criticizing Netanyahu because they see the handwriting on the wall. And it's interesting, Obama used the term Palestinian demographics, mm-hmm. which is a racist term. Sure. I mean, it's a racist way of thinking.
They're just saying there's too many blacks in the neighborhood.
Yes, yes.
It's too many Palestinians, too many Arabs in the neighborhood. It's the same racist terminology.
And he also referred to the fact that Israel lives in a rough neighborhood. Well, usually you tell the person, then maybe move.
Well, if it's a bully that is bullying everybody,
yes.
They're creating that rough neighborhood by themselves. Yes. Israel attacked Lebanon, attacked Syria, attacked Iraq, attacked Tunisia, attacked Egypt, attacked Jordan, and is shopping to try to attack Iran. And therefore, saying that it's a rough neighborhood, well, if you're carrying the biggest stick and beating everybody around, then the roughness that is coming from the neighborhood is of your own making.
That's true. So. It's interesting, by the way, getting to Iran, is that the biggest applause, the big push is still to go after Iran. And, mm-hmm. and there also seems to be conflict within the Iranian government at the moment between President Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, mm-hmm. Of who is actually running the show.
Well, the thing is that Iran has its own problems. There's no question
totally
about it.
Totally apart from everything else.
It has its own problems. There's different power centers that are there. Definitely those who benefited from the revolution are attempting to maintain their economic benefits. All that being taken, then looking at what Israel interests in terms of Iran and why it wants to at least challenge Iran's ability to acquire nuclear weapons if the Iranians would like to acquire nuclear weapons, because Israel wants to maintain its hegemonic presence in the region, to be the only regional power without any competitor, and have to have the freedom of operation across the Middle East. And I think if you notice, Obama said that he is committed, the United States committed to maintain the qualitative edge for Israel militarily in the region, which means that we will maintain Israel as the bully to be able to beat any Arab or Muslim country in the region or their combined forces together. Therefore, Iran, have to be understood, it does not constitute a threat to the United States. It constitutes a possibility of a balance of power with Israel if it's acquired nuclear weapon. That's why if you talk to any sound-minded military strategist, it tells you that a nuclear Iran does not constitute a threat to the United States. We were able to at least have a containment of the Soviet Union with considerable nuclear weapons. Iran with one nuclear warhead or two nuclear warheads does not constitute an existential threat to the United States, but definitely it would balance power with Israel in the region. That's why the Israelis would like the United States to be the one that carries the attack for them on Iran and eliminate Iran's nuclear program. And if not, Iran is already thinking and already had some negotiations with the Arab countries, in particular Saudi Arabia, for a possible bridge for them to pass through Saudi Arabian airspace for an attack if they would like to undertake, and there is that possibility because I think the Israelis are training on such an attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities. The U.S. military, on the other hand, does not want this to take place, and they've been actually the ones that resisting the calls for an attack. Dick Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney, during the last days of Bush's presidency, actually was chopping and urging for an attack on Iran. It's actually my reading of it that the U.S. military was the one that stopped the attack from occurring. So I think that's what yesterday's his Netanyahu speech in the Congress was actually saying, that all options are on the table, was wanting that military option to be the option that to be chosen. But I don't think that the alignment of forces in the U.S. Would go in that direction, because it means chaos for the U.S. in managing its own interests outside of the Iranian-Israeli confrontation.
And also what that war would mean impact on a global economy that's already barely surviving. I mean, add a war with Iran and the possible, even the likelihood of a cutoff of oil from the whole region, you would have an economic disaster, which points to the fact how America has allowed itself to have its enemies, Israel's enemies, become its enemies.
Well, that's what, you know, George Washington in his farewell speech is, to have an alliance that essentially you pick their enemies because you have already went overboard to try to appease that alliance that you have struck. And here Israel is basically adding to our enemy list. And even if you take and assess from a realist political perspective U.S. national interest, Israel is not serving or assisting U.S. national interest. We could critique U.S. national interest, it's a different discussion, but even as a realist political observer and saying, here's U.S. national interest, I would say it is not in U.S. national interest to attack Iran. It's not in U.S. national interest to actually add to our list of enemies. It is not in U.S. national interest to have the 350 million Arab world taking an antagonistic relationship to the United States. And it's not in our national interest to have 1.2 billion Muslims being antagonistic to us because we want to serve Israel's interests and Israel's continued violation of international law, expansion of settlement, oppression of the Palestinians. And therefore, the only question becomes the role of this lobby effort, the role of AIPAC, the role of the political machinery that maintain the U.S. Congress and the U.S. political leadership firmly on the side of Israel, while the U.S. public, I would say, is somewhere else.
And also, when the U.S. wants to have influence on the developments of all the Arab countries, that their support for Israel simply contradicts that and gets in the way of that. Yeah, that also brings us up to the point of the potential raising in the U.N. in September of Palestinian nationhood, which Obama is lobbying against at this very moment in all the halls of England. It's interesting, the New York Times today reported, despite the very friendly barbecue and friendship extended between David Cameron and Obama, New York Times reported that Cameron has not agreed to withhold support for Palestinian state, as Obama has lobbied him to do. And it would seem that one of the things Obama wants to come back and tell to the American Jewish community, the Zionist part, community, is I stopped this from happening. You see, and what is the potential benefits of bringing the Palestine issue to the UN in September?
Well, I'm looking at this as one additional strategic step on the Palestinians to maintain the international presence and pressure on Israel, and put, once again, the right of the Palestinians at the international table, especially in the General Assembly, which every time that there is a vote in the General Assembly, the Palestinians get overwhelming support with almost four or five opposition only. United States, Israel, Micronesia, Marshall Islands,
Wow.
And so countries that are such critical pieces of the world system that shows you the consensus of support for Israel. So I think the Palestinians have already seen that the negotiating table that they have been sitting on has been sitting on top of them rather than assisting them. There is such an imbalance, asymmetry of power on the negotiating table, where you're actually negotiating with your occupier and the occupier is supported by the United States, the major superpower, that is pressing Israel's interests on the negotiating table rather than trying to create a balanced relationship in terms of the negotiations. So 20 years of negotiations that the Palestinians have engaged in through the Palestinian National Authority and the PLO have resulted in the following. One, Palestinians have lost more land during negotiations than in the years before. More expansion of settlements. Palestinian political position has been tremendously weakened. And fourth, that the Palestinian leadership has been almost subsumed to be almost an adjunct of the occupation in the Palestinian territories, in particular in the West Bank. And on top of it, you had a security infrastructure that has been trained right now by General Miller. Before him, General Dayton. General Miller was the person who was responsible for Abu Ghraib, who was the head of Abu Ghraib. He was also served in Bagram base in Afghanistan. And before that, he was actually very active in Latin America. So we transformed the Palestinian Security Force, essentially as another arm of the occupation force. So 20 years for the Palestinians has demonstrated that Israel's strategy of negotiations is using negotiations as a way to create facts on the ground, and the facts of the ground becomes essentially subject to the dictates of negotiations, and this is where these land swaps are a result of 20 years of creating facts on the ground. So the strategy, once again, is to place the issue in front of the international community as a strategic step. I don't think that the international community is going to make a difference for the Palestinians on the ground, but it does create this strategic perspective on the worldwide community that there is something seriously wrong in here. And then I think the changes in the Arab world, as well as in the Palestinian street, relative to the agreements between the various Palestinian factions, will make a change happen. But it's not in the immediate future. I think it's a long-term change that is coming, and I think we need to assess it from that perspective.
Well, it's interesting, using a terminology that has been created, the negotiation between the parties. In an interview yesterday, I've said it's like having the rapist, the woman who's been raped, have a negotiation, negotiate a settlement with her raper, while the world looks on or the police look on. The term peace process involves the notion that there's a war. There was a war. The Israelis won that war in 48. They continued in 67. And today in Israel, people don't live under a war. They're very comfortable. And in fact, they do not believe that they even need any kind of process. And so there's no angst there. There's no desire to rush to the table on the part of Netanyahu. They said that he was coming here to present a proposal which would get the Palestinians back to the table. This is obviously propaganda for the mainstream media to make people believe Israel wants a settlement with the Palestinians. And in fact, why should they want that? They keep increasing. They announce every time there's an event like this, we hear a new announcement now, 1,600 new units or 400 new units. And it just happens to come.
But before before he left,
yes,
Israel, exactly, to visit, yes, they announced the new settlement expansions to take place of 1,600 units before he flew to the United States. If anything, it reminds us a year and a half ago when Biden stood there,
exactly,
and was slapped up and down, right?
Yes.
And by the announcement of settlement expansion while he's standing in there, not even having the diplomatic courtesy of waiting for him to be in the hotel before you announce it right there in front of him, and adding insult to injury when he came back, actually the State Department has to apologize. And people were actually apologizing for Netanyahu slapping our vice president.
And James Baker, when he was Secretary of State, used to say the same thing, that every time he would go over to Israel, they would announce new settlements.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about this latest time is the State Department had no statement about the new settlement. It just shows how they're acquiescing. One of the things that also occurred to me was the terminology used by Netanyahu and Obama. When Netanyahu referred to Israel being a state of Jewish citizens, remember, Avigdor Lieberman has proposed a swap in which the whole area in what's called Israel, where where the Palestinians live would become part of a Palestinian state, and some part of Israel where there are no Jews living would become part of a Palestinian state, and which would then leave a totally Jewish state. Yes. And Netanyahu, and I believe Obama, referred to the Jewish state. So this
that's a shift in the U.S. position, once again, that we need to this, is that Israel will be the homeland of the Jewish people, and that the Palestinian state to be the homeland of the Palestinian people with land swap. And essentially what the Israelis want is to shift what's called in the triangle up in the north, as well as possibly the Galilee, that part of the population, which would be about 18% of the Arab population, 18% of the population of Israel is Arab, will be shifted to the Palestinians. And in return, the Israelis will take all the land that has been annexed as settlements and will be incorporated in Israel, which means that an Israeli state, which is democratic, would let go without the consultation of that 20% of its population, shift them to another state to be in terms of their planning. And therefore, it's here, once again, Israel would achieve the transfer policy by means of an agreement that agreed to by whoever representing is the Palestinians, which would be unselected, and acquiesced by the United States. And I think both the Obama speech and Netanyahu's speech have emphasized this, and I think that's where we are heading, which is a very important, very significant. The second part is that settling all claims, final claims, meaning in here the Palestinian refugees, claims of right of return would be completely snuffed, and there is no right of return for the Palestinians, which about 6.5 million to 7 million that are living in exile in refugee camps, that their rights will be completely nullified. And I think both Obama is consenting to this, as well as Netanyahu is already signaling that this is it for this agreement. Lastly, I also would like to mention that Netanyahu, in his speech, actually said even more that Israel is not an occupying power. And that is actually throwing the book in the face of every congressman and every political leader sitting there, assuming that they have fought something. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that they were thinking. That essentially the standing U.S. position that the occupied territories are occupied, per Resolution 242 and subsequent resolution. Netanyahu stood there is that we are not an occupying power. And further says that this is the Jewish land and we are sharing it with the Palestinians, meaning it's the Palestinians who are an addition to the rights of the land, not the other way around. And people stood up, these congressmen stood up and clapped to that specific statement, meaning that they're actually going contrary to U.S. standing position and U.S. standing policies from 1967 up to this point, as well as this U.S. standing policy from 1948 per Resolution 181 that Jerusalem is an occupied land as well. And that was just like an amazing scenery to see this speech and to see the presentation that was given there. If anything, it was extremely triumphant in terms of Netanyahu, knowing that he has no challenge whatsoever from any part of the U.S. government, that he already have slapped the president at least twice, once in the White House and once on an APEC speech. And he knows that the Democratic Party is already silent on this, and the Republicans are more triumphant in terms of their support for Israel. So it's a complete conquest of U.S. foreign policy landscape when it comes to Israel and the Palestine-Israel aspect of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, the only question from the Netanyahu performance, whether he got 29 or 34 standing ovations.
Yeah. Well, there was a few people that stayed standing
the whole time.
So that
the whole time, and actually, it was a comparison in Obama's State of the Union speech in 2010. He got 21 standing ovations. So here is a visiting prime minister getting a minimum of 29. Another term that has been really used to mislead and been very effective has been the notion of a two-state solution. Mm-hmm. Even the notion, and the term occupation, Occupation implies something that's static.
Mm-hmm.
This is a creeping dispossession. So it's not occupation, it's more than occupation. And the two states really ignore the fact, in retrospect, that as of 1967, it has been one state,
mm-hmm.
Mandate Palestine, with a huge section of people inhabiting that, the Palestinians, having no rights whatsoever. And in that case, the notion that it's a democratic state is as it was as applicable as it was to South Africa under apartheid. And I think there's a debate, one state versus two states, I think it needs to be framed in the fact that since 67, it has really been one state. And the Israelis see it as one state.
Well, I think the Israelis have been working from the 1936-37 policy of the need to transfer the Palestinians out of historical Palestine. And at least Avigdor Lieberman, he constantly says in every opportunity that there is a Palestinian state that's called Jordan. He said that in a number of places, a number of settings, and that's at least his standing point of view, as well as considerable segment within his political party, Israel Beituna, as well as within the Likud, there is this belief. So if you actually take it from 1947, the actual expulsion, and continuously up to 67 and now, Israel has maintained the pressure to push the Palestinians out, sometimes during direct confrontation, sometimes during this period of negotiation, quote-unquote, expansion of settlements, withdrawing or taking away people's residency permits. It seems that just last 2 weeks ago, Israel announced that they had taken 140,000 residency permits from the Palestinians, meaning they are expelled without actually being expelled because you removed their...
Well, they had those who had left the same way 6 months and they came back to find out that they were no longer able to live there.
So that's another way, which is, we call it the silent ethnic cleansing, because you don't see it, you don't witness it. So it is one state that has a large Palestinian population, and so far from the inception of Israel, the main issue has been how to get rid of the Palestinians who are living in their own homes and in their own lands. How to bring about a land without a people for a people without a land. But in here, we have a land with a people that we need to make it into a land without a people, meaning the people here are the Palestinians. So I think the strategy, once again, is how to push the Palestinians out and to find a way for those who remain is to create a political contents for them so you are not responsible for them while taking all the key ingredients within this so-called militarized state that's supposed to be granted to Palestinians, including the Jordan Valley, the water, the strategic lands and everything. And you also shift some of your own Palestinian population that is living in the 48, that you see it as a security threat internally. So that's where the strategy of Israel. However, I think Israel is unable to achieve any of its goals. It has a fundamental problem right now, both in terms of its own structure internally, and also with the changes that have occurred upon the Arab and Muslim world. I think what we call the Arab Spring. This Arab Spring came as a result of a long, long hot summer and a long, cold winter. People think that it's only Facebook and people just got on Facebook and all of a sudden revolution took place. That's just like what you call the idiot guide of how revolution takes place and what happened in the Arab world. Yes, people access these social media, but the ingredients of revolutions in the Arab world were long, long in making. If you want to look at Egypt, I would say that the ingredients of revolutions today in Egypt predates Mubarak, predates Sadat, and can go back all the way to the 1953 revolutions, which is the Free Officers Revolution, which once again, it was a military coup. And the military coup managed to suppress the popular uprising. Nasser was a great figure that he mobilized public sentiment, but still it was not a revolution in terms of changing the whole elite with the existing elite with a new grassroots popular uprising. But even Nasser was frustrated by the U.S.-Israeli-Saudi attempt to derail Arab nationalist attempt. They derailed the unity agreement between Syria and Egypt, also entangled Nasser in Yemen, in the war in Yemen, which was funded by the Saudis at the time, and the Israelis were helping also at that early stage. So that revolution that took place, or the coup of 1953, was essentially part of the broader Cold War that Israel and the United States were able to create a reflection of it in the Arab world, resulting in the collapse of Arab nationalism and began to become what you call bureaucratic and autocratic regimes, authoritarian regimes that were won the day, and monarchies coming the successful participant of this, Saudi Arabia becoming really the key victor of that Cold War and defeating Nasser by means of this entanglement. So that revolution is connected to that period, and time and time again, one mass mobilization, one mass attempt by the populations in Egypt, first and foremost, because it's the largest Arab country with the largest, with the longest history, with the center of cultural production, mm-hmm. with the center of intellectual production, had constant attempts to try to come out. Then you had Sadat, who also shifted away and realized that Nasser was defeated and the Arab nationalists were defeated, so he allied himself with the Saudis and allied himself with the United States, and then a new period of political manipulation came, and resulting in this alignment, the Camp David Agreement, as well as the use of Islam as a mobilizing tool to confront Iran Shia revolution and to confront the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So, interestingly enough, Sadat was calling himself the believing president, Ra'is al-Mu'min, the believing president, because he wanted to wear the cloak of religion, because that was the new strategy, right? The new strategy of how to capture the challenge to Shia Iran, would, and also to confront the atheist, ungodly Russians in Afghanistan, and therefore that begins the period from the late 70s that gets Sadat into that position. Then Mubarak inherits the same strategy and even goes further in his subservient position, both to the United States and to Israel and to the status quo in the Arab world.
And that was a major part of a conversation I had last on May 25th with Professor Dr. Hatem Bazian, University of California in Berkeley, filmed by and recorded by Collision Course Video, which is available on the internet.